Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Washington Weekly Podcast on the UBS In The Now podcast channel. Joining us once again for the conversation, glad to welcome back Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs US here at UBS. Shane, thank you for dropping by the podcast on this Friday morning. Welcome back. Looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's good to be back with you.
So, Shane, to begin, I thought we could follow up on a topic you actually spent some time previewing for us last week, that being the rulings out of the Supreme Court expected in the coming weeks. This is actually quite fluid. As we're speaking, we're expected to receive additional opinions from the Supreme Court. Though one in particular I wanted to focus in on, which we did receive this week, the Supreme Court upheld the U.S. tax on foreign business income. Can you provide some background on this and maybe speak to the implications?
Yeah, you're right in the sense that this is fluid. As you know, you and I are speaking right now, the Supreme Court is releasing more decisions, and they just released an 8-1 decision to uphold a federal law that disarms people under domestic abuse violence restraining order. So to the point, you know, this is a live fire exercise, if you will, in the sense that rulings are coming out right now. But you're right. This the case you mentioned is the Moore versus the United States, and it's one we've been following because it has it had potential for, you know, some real big implications for the tax code. This case stems from the 2017 tax law and a specific provision in it, known as the repatriation tax, which said to U.S. multinational companies that had profits overseas that they had not brought home yet and therefore were not taxed on. The law said, you know, essentially, you can bring that money back, you can leave it there, you know, but we're going to tax you like you are bringing it back. And that money was used to offset some of the other taxes and bills. So this case was that a tax on unrealized gains that and is taxing unrealized gains unconstitutional. So the Supreme Court, you know, in theory could have had this big ruling, you know, that would have actually impacted, you know, up to 1/3 of our entire tax code and could really have upset the apple cart, if you will. But I think they kind of saw some of the ramifications, and in a 7-2 ruling, said that Congress has the power to do what they did in this one-time mandatory repatriation tax on overseas earnings. But they also, you know, put a big asterisk next to the ruling, you know, essentially saying that this should not be misconstrued on us saying yes or no to a wealth tax in the future, a wealth tax on unrealized gains, I should say. As we have talked about in the past, there are a number of Democrat lawmakers who have been talking about legislation and introduced legislation to tax unrealized gains specifically on the wealthy. So a lot of people were looking to see if this case would, you know, prevent that before even move forward. So this is an interesting ruling. Like I said, it does not rule in or rule out a potential wealth tax on unrealized gains. So, you know, it will provide a lot of fodder in the coming weeks, months, and years for Democrats to continue to pursue such an option. Now, we don't think any such wealth tax is going to be enacted, you know, this year or next year, but it's something that we're keeping an eye on for the long-term prospects.
Well, Shane, thank you for the clarity on this particular ruling, and we'll continue to keep our eyes on the Supreme Court. As mentioned, it is quite fluid with other rulings coming in. I do want to turn overseas a bit since we last spoke. We did see the G7 summit held in Italy. Any notable takeaways from the summit? And can you speak a bit to the focuses and themes from this year's summit?
Yeah, as per usual, I would say they covered a lot of ground, you know, everything from AI, economic security, immigration was a big topic, the war on Gaza, climate change, Iran, the Middle East as a whole. But a specific topic was financial support for Ukraine, where there was an agreement that they would support Ukraine and use frozen Russian assets as collateral, which was swiftly condemned by Russian President Putin. And it really draws a line in the sand, and you see, you know, kind of G7 and Europe and industrialized countries really, you know, standing strong at this moment against Russia's actions in Ukraine. But, you know, to your point, that was not the sole focus. You know, a lot of conversations, as I said, about migration. You know, you have this G7 summit was held in Italy, and the leader of Italy, Meloni, she has taken a tough stance on migration, as a lot of migrants from North Africa come to Europe via Italy. So they're kind of maybe the first stop often. And, you know, the country of Italy is trying to get support for trying to figure out ways to stem the tide, whether it be, you know, helping African nations develop their own resources to make, you know, staying in Africa a better option. And you saw support not just from Italy for this, but UK's Rishi Sunak was on board. So, you know, I think, you know, Europe is starting to take a different look at migration patterns than they have in the past, you know, 20 years. I mentioned AI, but I think we need to reiterate it. You know, AI is a topic that we've talked about in the past, and I think we'll continue to talk about in the coming years, as it is so impactful to the future of not only the U.S., but the entire world.
Well, Shane, thank you for providing some highlights of this year's G7 summit. Certainly a lot of takeaways. Sticking with geopolitics, there have been some headlines this week surrounding a newly announced military pact involving Russia and North Korea. This did raise a lot of eyebrows. What did the terms consist of to the extent that we know? And what would you say are the implications of such an agreement, this in consideration of the ongoing global conflict involving Russia in Ukraine?
Yeah, this was quite noteworthy. Vladimir Putin traveled to North Korea. He also went to, I think, Vietnam afterwards, so it wasn't just North Korea. But the focus was his visit to North Korea and with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. This was his first visit since the year 2000, so 24 years. So it really showed him putting a foot forward to build a stronger relationship with North Korea. And they came to an agreement on a new pact, if you will, to enhance their relationship to a, quote, comprehensive strategic partnership, end quote. And what that really means is that if one of the countries is involved in a military provocation where they're invaded and they're starting a war, that the other side will, you know, commit weapons and possibly troops. So, you know, some of this is bluster in the sense that, you know, North Korea has been talking about South Korea or the U.S. invading them since 1953, when the armistice between North Korea and South Korea happened. You know, they have for that time period acted like it's just around the corner that, you know, the South Koreans or the U.S. would invade them. And obviously it's not happened. So this is kind of a mentality they've had for decades. But this is, I think, to some extent benefits Russia more because, you know, it helps them, you know, get some weapons out of North Korea into Russian hands, as they are in dire need of more munitions in their war in Ukraine. It also kind of rebuffs and sends a signal to Europe that says, you know, while you may be aiding, you know, don't cross a line. There is some concern that, you know, well, does this mean that if country A gives Ukraine weapons, that, you know, means that, you know, that widens the war, if you will. So a lot of interest in this. I think it is telling, you know, where we are at this point. You know, 20 some odd years ago, President George W. Bush talked about the axis of evil with Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. I think, you know, we're at a point where it's really now Iran, North Korea, and Russia as maybe the new axis of evil, if you will. You know, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken didn't go that far, but he noted that these countries are of considerable concern. So that's, you know, him being a little maybe more diplomatic about this. But I think the writing is on the wall that Russia and North Korea are probably going to be an issue for the Western world to deal with, not for just the next year or two because of the war in Ukraine, but for possibly decades to come. So, you know, I don't know if that I would go as far as saying this is a new Cold War, but, you know, it has some of the makings of that development.
Well, Shane, really appreciate that color on what was a very interesting development this week. And of course, the Russia-Ukraine war ongoing and does remain a very delicate situation. Though, Shane, as always, thank you for dropping by, spending some time with our listeners, our clients, keeping them informed on a range of topics and issues. And I do look forward to picking back up with our conversation in the week ahead.
Looking forward to it, Dan. I hope you have a great weekend and, you know, are able to stay out of the heat a little bit.
Definitely. Enjoy the weekend, Shane, and hope you stay cool as well. Again, today we have been joined by Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs US here at UBS. I do want to point out to our listeners and our clients of UBS, you can now locate the latest Washington Weekly publication on ubs.com/Washington Weekly. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.